May thy knife chip and shatter. Welcome to Primary Technology, the show about the tech news that matters. Early reviews of the Humane AI pin are out, so we're going to touch on those. Apple released a new research paper on a possible large language model, maybe coming to a future iOS. Plus, they're really trying to get business users to use Apple Vision Pro. Google's AI photo features are coming to more devices, including the iPhone, and a ton more. This episode is brought to you by you, those who support the show directly. I'm one of your hosts, Stephen Robles, and joining me, as always, my friend Jason Aiton. How's it going, Jason?
Good. Mostly, you're going to be joined today by my allergies, so I apologize in advance. If I just start crying, it has nothing to do with Steven.
No.
I'm not that emotional. It's just my eyes are on fire for the next.
And they're not on fire from using Apple Vision Pro because you don't have one.
I do not have one. That's not why they are on fire. I do not have that problem. Maybe it would be better if I could just wear something over my face all the time.
That is true.
Honestly, during COVID, I didn't have allergies for 2 years because I was wearing a mask all the time and the pollen. Defeated the pollen, so
couldn't get to you.
But for the next 6 weeks, pretty much I just want to rip my eyes out, so I apologize in advance. So
I do not suffer from allergies, so I am, I guess, one of the lucky ones. But
yes,
my wife and all my kids do, so yes, it's crazy. I said another Dune quote. Now, I won't typically duplicate movie quotes at the beginning of our episodes, but Dune Part 2 is going to be available to stream on digital. You can buy it this Tuesday, April 16th. You can watch it, which is only like a month and a half after it released in theaters, which is a crazy quick turnaround. But maybe they're expecting like another huge like flow of cash, which I'm one of them. I pre-ordered it already. I'll be watching it next Tuesday. But yeah, because had you seen it in theaters?
I haven't seen Dune 2, but I want to touch on this because I didn't know where you're going with the movie quote. But this is, you can draw a straight line between this and Taylor Swift. Seriously. I'm not kidding. She taught the Hollywood studios how you do this. Mm. Because if you think about it, right, she sold $1 billion worth of tickets for people to come see her live.
Right.
Then she released her concert in the movie theaters and sold, I don't even know, several $100 million worth of tickets.
Yeah.
Then she released it for renting on digital platforms, right? Yes. And then she released it on Disney Plus as a streaming thing. And all the Hollywood studios are like just sitting there with calculators going, oh my gosh, she sold the same movie experience to the same people four times. Four times, Steven. Right? The same people went and saw it live, saw it in theaters, rented it, and then streamed it.
She repurposed.
She figured out like the secret formula, and which is amazing because she's not a Hollywood executive, and yet she did a far better job of the understanding business. Release windows than any studio ever has understood. And so we're going to start seeing that where it's like, okay, well, we've hit the tipping point of where the box office receipts are going down. Now let's make it available for purchase, and then we'll make it available later on probably Max, right?
Honestly, makes total sense. I also, this is the first time we've actually jumped right into a topic. I mean, we're talking about streaming right now because I saw a clip from the Hot Ones show where, you know, that guy eats hot wings and asks actors things. And he was talking to Matt Damon asking about like why studios or actors can't make movies that they used to, maybe like the smaller films that wouldn't make as much money. And Matt Damon was talking about how back when VHS and DVDs were a thing, that studios could really depend on like a second wave of income from those DVD and VHS sales, which I imagine also like played into like Blockbuster or whatever, because they would probably buy a bunch of copies of the movie just to rent out. And so that second wave of income has not really existed recently because of the streaming services. So I do wonder, to your point, if, you know, Dune Part 2 is like, there's still hype around the movie now. If we release it just to purchase, not stream, you know, it's not like you'll be able to stream it on Max or wherever for free with your subscription, but to actually pay $30 to watch it at home only a month later, I think that's probably smarter than waiting 6 months, because if someone has the patience to wait 6 months to buy it on digital, they have even more patience to wait for it to come out on Netflix or HBO Max. And so like they're not going to pay $30, but to watch it just a month after it was out in theaters for $30, that's way cheaper than movie tickets, and probably more likely people will do it.
Yeah, and at this point, everybody who is willing to pay money to go sit in a theater to watch this movie has already done that. So let's just either let them pay again to watch it at home, or all of the rest of us who haven't been to the theaters who would like to watch it. So
that's it. Let them. Well, anyway, the other quote you were talking about was "Let them fight," which was last week's quote, and you said someone reached out to you about it.
Well, no. So I think it was 2 weeks ago, but we told people in their 5-star reviews to tell us what the quote, and then you and I forgot that that was what we had asked people to do. Correct. But I do think we should give credit to, it looks like it was SL-41, who you gave them credit for the 5-star review last week, but the title of their review is Godzilla versus Muta, which is what, it's from the first Godzilla movie, not first Godzilla, the, what is it, 2017 Godzilla movie, the fight between the two. So that's I just wanted to make sure that we justly called out SL-41. Thank you not only for the 5-star review, but for actually like paying attention and doing the thing we asked.
And doing the thing. And a few people actually, I don't know if it was last week, or I cut out the movie quote in the video version last week because I was just in a rush to edit. And we actually got a couple complaints. They said we missed the obscure quote at the beginning. So it will remain. We will continue doing it, of course.
Great.
And other 5-star review shout outs. Remember, if you give us a 5-star rating and review in Apple Podcasts, you get a shout out. So mslur146436 29 aperture. Battery percentage off, Jason. Just want you to know we had one person mention the battery and it was off. Big Papa 0205 and Kevin JT. So thank you for those 5-star reviews. Very fun.
That's great.
All right. So today, as April 11th, as we record, this was supposed to be the day that Humane AI Pin was shipping to those who ordered first or priority orders. I don't have mine yet. I don't have a shipping notification, but reviews dropped. Multiple reviews are out, including David Pierce at The Verge has an official Humane AI pin review. I got a long video showing him using it around New York City and talking about it. So we'll put this link to the review in the show notes. I obviously want to talk about this way more when I have mine in hand, and hopefully that will be soon. Humane said that they're going to be fulfilling orders all April, and I should have not tried to play this video while I was talking because I was trying to mute it, but instead, anyway, so if you watch on youtube.com/@primarytechshow, you get visuals too.
Yeah.
Anyway, he used the pin for a while, and basically the main takeaways were the hardware is really cool, especially for the first hardware device from a new company. You know, this is Humane's first device and service. So the hardware is cool, and the when it works, it's cool. But according to David Pierce, he felt like 1 out of 3 times is when it worked. There was much higher percentage when it just either gave misinformation, like misidentified a building or a brand and basically made something up. Hallucinating is the term we use when an AI model actually makes it up, or he said it would just overheat and stop working. There's several parts in the video where the pin is like, the AI pin has to cool down for a moment and just give us a second. It's like, well, that's not a great experience. I've experienced that on my iPhone sometimes here in Florida, especially at the beach. You know, it'll say like, too hot, you know, you gotta wait a second. But that's been maybe twice in the decades that I've had iPhone. So, you know, that's not a great experience for a device that ideally you want to be able to use. It doesn't even have a screen. You know what I mean? For it overheat. And
it's not just that you want to be able to use it. It's not ideal for a device you wear on your clothing to get extremely hot.
That's, right? That's
like,
true.
I don't know how hot it's getting, but I will tell you that I have had iPhones that overheated and you touch them and they're like, okay, we're going to put you in a, you know, an ice bath or something right now because they, you know, it's mostly because of the screen trying to compensate for the fact that the sun is very bright and that heats the whole thing up. But obviously this doesn't have a screen, and so it must be working real hard, but I'm not sure I want to be wearing something that is going to have to shut down because it's too hot.
Yeah, so that, you know, it's still missing some features. I like how in the Verge review they just say, really slow, even when it does work. So, you know, again, I appreciate the aspirational nature of this product. I think of any product recently, aspirational is the most germane word to use to describe this. I still love nerdy stuff, and so I'm excited to use this. He also, in the video, showed the ink display, the laser ink display, which would project on your hand. And as you would expect, it's really awkward to use that and not a great experience. He said just trying to put in the pin to unlock the device, which you have to do every time you detach the little magnet off the back and take it off your clothes, which you'll be doing several times a day because the battery is not going to last all day. So you have several batteries you have to swap out, and you'll have to unlock it with this laser ink display multiple times. So, you know, it's a finicky thing. It's obviously a Gen 1 product. You might even say a beta product, but I'm excited to try mine. Hopefully I get it soon, but we'll put a link to this review in the show notes. You can watch David Pierce ask it what buildings are. The first part of the review is basically David Pierce just saying like, what is this? Look at this. What is this? And it correctly identified Bulbasaur as a Pokemon, but did not identify like a lot of other things.
The New York Stock Exchange or whatever. But the only thing I take exception to is I don't think that Humane can get away calling this a beta product because they're charging $699 for it plus a monthly subscription for like the cellular service or whatever. So, and it's notable that in the Verge's Vision Pro review, which was not exceptionally positive, it was sort of, I think the headline was something like, it's magic till it's not. So the point was like, it's really cool, except for that you hit a wall and then it is terrible. Right. They gave that a 7. They gave the Humane AI Pen a 4, which is a fairly low score by Verge standards.
That is
so, meaning like you have to earn a 4, is I guess what I'm trying to say. And and it sounds like the Humane AI Pen did. I think that the $700 price point factors into that, because if the takeaway is it just doesn't work half the time, I think people expect more than that from a product that they're going to pay this much money for and that has been hyped up this much. And sure, I give them like the grace that it's probably going to get better, but this is the device that they're selling right now and they're asking you for $700 and it doesn't work half the time. That seems problematic.
Yeah. And you know, I feel like we've almost been spoiled by how good so much technology is today. You know, as I was traveling to Los Angeles the other day, I took an Uber to like an Apple store and literally the only thing I brought with me was my phone, you know, like the clothes in my back and my phone. And to get back to my hotel, I knew I was going to have to hail another Uber to get back. And I didn't even think about like, oh no, what if the Uber app just like crashes on me and I can't order a car, or somehow my phone dies and I can't turn it back on? I don't even think about that. I don't even think about, will my phone not work in an hour? Which, if you used computers for multiple decades, like Jason and I, that was not always the case. I mean, my compact Presario when I was growing up was not reliable. There were times where it would just die. And
Control Alt Delete was like the first thing you had to learn on a PC.
Exactly. So, and I wasn't using Macs back when I was like in junior high and high school. So maybe it was more reliable, but that reliability, I think, is something normal people just take for granted now, which I think, and rightly so, because stuff is really reliable, like iPads, iPhones. I remember when I was in college, I would record our concerts that I was playing in with my G4 12-inch PowerBook. I would set up GarageBand on the front row, hit record at the beginning of the concert, get on stage to play. So I wasn't even looking at the computer for like an hour and a half, get down off the stage when the concert was over and hit stop. And I never lost a recording. I mean, and I recorded probably like 8 or 9 concerts a year for 4 years. And it was just reliable. Like GarageBand was just reliable. So the fact that it doesn't work 2/3 of the time, I do think is a problem. So we'll see. Also, while I was on that Verge Humane AI review, I just saw this news about Sonos. So I'm going to throw this in there. Apparently, there's a new Sonos app coming May 7th, and it's like totally redesigned and stuff. And so this guy, do you have Sonos stuff?
I have zero Sonos things in our house. I mean, I don't know where we would have room for them. I mean, our television set up in the living room, which is where we normally ever watch stuff, just has 2 HomePods. And you know what? They're original HomePods and they still work just fine. They do. They don't disconnect like randomly. They work fine. Like,
wait, you know. Say they disconnect randomly, but
no,
they
I'm saying
fine?
They don't disconnect randomly. Okay. I hear people talk about this all the time, that they have gremlins living in their HomePods. And I'm like, I don't think I've thought about our HomePods in 5 years. They just work fine.
Okay. Well, there you go. Well, I use a bunch of Sonos stuff. And to your point, I had to unplug my Sonos Beam from the wall and plug it back in to get it to reconnect. So I don't know. Maybe this app will fix it. But there's that. All right. Some Apple news. iOS 17.5 Beta 1 came out recently for the developers. And there's some stuff in there, including a new puzzles collection within the Apple News app. And I just wanted to mention this because, listen, I'm a diehard Wordle and Connections player. And you're going to have to pry that out of my cold, dead hands for me to try it. No, just kidding. No, but for real, I do it every day. And we do it with some friends. And so I appreciate Apple trying to get into the puzzle game with 17.5. I don't know if I have enough bandwidth to add more puzzles to my daily life, but looks cool. I don't know. Do you do any of those?
No. I mean, Wordle, only because my daughter still does Wordle. And so that's kind of a fun thing. But I don't have a lot of time in my life just to play games. I hear people talk
about
like,
humble bragging, Jason. No, you have time to play Wordle.
Wordle, sure, but Wordle takes what? 3.5 minutes?
Yeah. Connections could take longer depending.
Yeah. So I mean I think this is great. I think it's
Yeah, no, it's
you know,
good.
Clearly like games has been a huge part of the New York Times' strategy. And so it does make sense that Apple's like, huh, maybe there's something there that would increase engagement. So, yeah.
Maybe you could play this on Apple Vision Pro. No, I'm just kidding.
Probably don't do that. Yeah, or your Humane AI pen. That'd be fun.
Oh, yeah, with a laser ink display.
I don't know.
This was part of the bigger news, was that Apple released a research paper. This is not the first time Apple's done this. This has been several times in the last year where they release a research paper on like large language models and AI. This one was interesting because there was a number of screenshots showing different UIs on the iPhone and explaining how this large language model, Ferret UI, F-E-R-R-E-T, would be able to like perform certain tasks or at least read what's on screen and then interact with what's on screen. And they trolled every Shortcuts user, Matthew Casanelli, Vitici, and myself, by basically putting screenshots in here of Shortcuts. Look at this. Shortcuts talking about the large language model. There's nothing really like, I'm going to say impressive. It's this research paper is not saying like, you can ask it to create an advanced shortcut for you and it will do it. It's not revealing that, but it is saying that this large language model can identify, you know, parts of what's on screen. It will understand, like, make me a simple shortcut or whatever. So anyway, this is just another point looking towards WWDC for iOS 18 that I think we're really going to hear about. I think Apple's just going to say AI. I think they're just going to say AI at WWDC. And they're going to talk about it in multiple contexts. And I think this is just another point to that argument.
Yeah. And I mean, they've been sort of leaning in that direction ever since they announced the M3 MacBook Pros, right? That was really the first time because it was the best computer ever for AI, which then the MacBook Air with M3 is the best computer ever for AI, which is just a funny thing to say about something that mostly happens in the cloud. But it's like it has Wi-Fi 6E. It's the best one ever for AI. But this is interesting because I think that this is where people will start to feel the benefits of AI as more than like I type something into ChatGPT. Because just imagine being able to like read an article and say, summarize this and send it to so-and-so. Or like do complex tasks where the AI system, let's call it Siri, in your iPhone is able to interact with the things that are on your screen in more complex ways and understand that. And that's really where the benefit of the LLMs comes in. And it's the ability for it to understand, do a thing, and then give you back information in a way that you can understand, as opposed to what Siri, for example, does now, which is like, huh? I don't understand, but here's some web links to something else that we've sent a
Wikipedia article to your phone.
Yeah, exactly. That's
what Siri does.
So I think that this would be, and I think the multimodal part of it is for it to be able to make sense of things like images on a screen, a video that's on a screen, and take information from that. And, you know, I don't know, maybe you could be watching a YouTube video and ask your phone, could you show me more videos that are like this? Or could you show me information about this thing that's not in the video? Your device would then be able to understand what that is and do something with that information. So,
which we were actually talking on social media yesterday, talking about reminders and messages and how you would really like to be able to link to a message, basically like long press on a message. And I just did a video about this on the YouTube channel, like all the different things you can long press on your iPhone. And you can long press on an individual text message in a thread, but there's not really any things you could do with it after that. So you long press on it, you can like add a sticker, copy, translate, and speak, but it really needs a share button. And one person pointed out in the replies of that thread that you used to be able to say, remind me of this on your iPhone, and it would basically do a deep link to that iMessage in a reminder, and then you can say, you know, remind me at this time. So he said it doesn't work anymore. I'm going to try it right now, live on air. So let's say, remind me about this text tomorrow at 9 a.m. So I just asked Siri to do that. It actually did it. It actually linked the iMessage thread in the reminder.
That's great. That's great that Siri will do that. But also, if I'm somewhere where I don't want to have to talk to my phone, I should just...
No, I know.
And honestly, as I thought more about it, because somebody did respond, like, I use Siri plus reminders all the time. I will just, my wife will say to me, hey, could you start the dishwasher after so-and-so gets on the bus? And I won't remember. So I just will say to my device, hey, remind me in a half an hour to do this thing. Like, and it works every time. And it's honestly my favorite feature of the watch. I just talk to my watch, remind me of this thing later. That's great. And it's great that it is somewhat context aware. It is so bizarre to me. And this is also true of Apple Mail, that you just don't have a share sheet that allows you to easily go between things. And what's wild about that is, like, I use Spark Email, and Spark Email has all of these capabilities for, you know, I can have an email, or I can have something and I can just tell it, like, add this to things, or add this to reminders, right, or add this to whatever. So, like, why is it that third party system services, like, have better access to stuff like this than, and my point is, how often do you get a message that you wish you could remember later because you're not at a good time to do something about it?
Right.
And one of the responses that I got was like, well, it would be wonderful if you could just mark it as unread. I don't want that red dot bothering me all day. I don't need that overhead mental baggage. I just want to be able to tell, you know, long press on my phone and say, add this to reminders, and just
that's it.
Let it remind me 6 hours later. Basically, I want to snooze it, but have it show up in a different context. Because when I sit down to go through tasks, I don't want to have to swipe through messages. Like, who wants to do that?
No, no, right, exactly. Also, mental baggage. That would be a great book title if you ever want to like write about that. That's pretty good. So this is, I just want to say, in reminders, this was the reminder I just created. So it says, Trevor Williamson was the text message conversation I was looking at. And it has a little message icon next to it. And I also wanted to mention, you can actually drag and drop from messages to reminders. I don't know if I could do this backwards, but like, if you're in messages, you can actually tap and hold on a conversation. You can't do this with an individual message, but you can actually swipe over. I don't even know if I'm still holding the conversation.
I think you are.
And then you can drop the conversation, and it will create a reminder with a link to that text message conversation that way, which is an interesting drag and drop function. Like, it's really hidden. I didn't even know you could do that.
Yeah, that's just about as discoverable as what you were talking about with Notion, right?
I know. Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Wonderful that you can do that finger gymnastics. I was not even sure what you were about to do. I swear I thought you were about to throw your phone. I don't even know how you did that.
It's super awkward. I'm actually going to do a whole video on like everything you can drag and drop, because you can actually do a lot of drag and drop on iPhone, but the finger gymnastics are crazy because you have to keep one finger on screen at the whole time and then swipe home with the other finger. Like, it's not sustainable. So I totally agree. You should just be able to long press on an individual text message and create a reminder with that.
You can do the Siri thing, and we're not going to add long press. But what you can do is long press and hold on the screen and then just do a bunch of other stuff. And yes, just, that's so much easier. I'm really glad. Yeah, thank you, Apple.
Not great. I am going to put in a shortcut in a future video where you could like copy it to clipboard and create a reminder with the text. But you can't get the deep link to a specific text message through shortcuts or any other way, which I found interesting. Like, I know there's deep links to mail, and like you can get a deep link to an individual message in mail if you use the stock mail app. And I thought you could do that with text messages too, where you could get a deep link to a specific message. So I'm going to ask the Primary Tech Show army out there, if anybody knows of a way to figure out how to get a deep link to an individual message, not the conversation, but an individual message. I don't think there's a way, because like Jason is saying, you long press on the message, there's no options.
You can add an exclamation point, or you can reply. And if you click more, it doesn't even do anything you'd expect.
It's weird.
More.
It goes into a different mode, which then lets you basically forward the message to someone else.
Yes, that's what more should be. Yep, absolutely. Like, yeah, you click more, and all it does is let you highlight more messages.
Right, exactly. And then forward those messages to someone else, which is you should not have a more menu option for just copying the text basically to somebody else. But anyway. Yeah.
Anyway,
this has been our rant on messages on iOS 17. Maybe iOS 18 and LLM will fix it.
I just feel like this seems like such an obvious thing. And yet, the shortcut things is great. You can use shortcuts to do a lot of things. The deep link thing, I don't know if that has anything to do with the Blast Door, which is their sort of sandbox around messages that doesn't, because that way, that's how they protect you from if you have someone sends you an image, but really that image has like some sort of embedded malware. Like it doesn't go beyond messages and stuff like that. So I don't know if there's some... I don't know if it has anything to do with that, but I just feel like shortcuts is a great solution, but it should not be the only way to do these things, because I feel like the 2 billion iPhone users, there has to be less than like a hundredth of a percentage of the, like, you know what I mean? Like there are not hundreds of millions of people using shortcuts. There has to be a better way.
There's hundreds of thousands because they've seen my shortcuts videos.
There may be hundreds of thousands, but out of 2 billion, I don't know. Steven, that's just me. I just watch them over and
you
over.
You just watch
again.
Them on repeat. Yep. Thank you.
And I haven't learned anything, so I'm really sorry.
No, that's not kidding. All right, last Apple thing. And then we'll move on. The big Department of Justice antitrust case with the United States DOJ suing Apple, there was a judge assigned, Michael E. Farbiars, but he's actually recused himself from the case. No specific reason was given, but there is a rule mentioned in the announcement, Canon 3C1D, which says a judge must disqualify themselves from a proceeding when the judge's impartiality might reasonably be questioned. And I'm curious, in a case like the DOJ versus Apple, I feel like anyone who uses a smartphone is going to have some impartiality about something. If they use an iPhone, there's probably some impartiality. If they're an Android user, there's probably some impartiality. So I'm curious, maybe he has like a friend or relative who works at Apple, maybe. But I found this interesting that something caused him to the judge to recuse himself from the case. And I don't know how anyone, I don't know.
It could be as simple as like someone has a retirement account and they realize like I have, you know, $800,000 worth of Apple stock in there or something. Yeah. I mean, who knows? And that's pretty benign. Like judges are allowed to have their money invested. The point is you don't want a judge that appears as though like that's the impartiality might reasonably be questioned. That doesn't mean that the person would do a bad job. It's just that you don't want to give either party the appearance that whatever decisions get made along the way could be because of this other thing. Maybe they have a spouse who once worked at Apple. Maybe they have a kid who worked on the thing that like sold a company to Apple or who, like, it's just, there's a lot of options, but like I actually saw somebody mention this and like, well, you know, a lot of judges come from the Department of Justice. But every single case that the U.S. brings, they can't have a new judge just because that judge was once an assistant U.S. attorney or something like that. The judges are generally pretty good at being impartial in those sort of situations. So my guess is it wasn't that the judge was thinking, I can't fairly decide this case. It was that there's some circumstance that people might look at and say, hey, you know, they were not impartial.
My theory is this judge went to an Apple store, got a demo of Apple Vision Pro, and it changed his life. And he said, I can't speak a bad word about this company. Apple Vision Pro changes everything.
Or maybe this judge, their favorite hobby is cloud game streaming. And so... Oh,
fair. Fair. He's mad.
He's a heavy Game Pass user.
That's right.
And it was just like they realized, you know, somebody shared a picture from like a Labor Day barbecue and there's like 7 Xboxes lined up with TVs and they're like, maybe this is not a good look for the judge on this case. I don't know.
Or he just plays Fortnite and he's mad it's not on the iPhone.
Okay, well, that's possible.
That's what it is. That's what it is. All right, to Google. I thought this was funny. Google, the AI editing tools in Google Photos, many of which were announced with like the Pixel 8 and Pixel 8 Pro last year, a lot of those features are going to be on iPhone and other Google phones if you use the Google Photos app. And this is starting May 15th, I believe. Yeah, May 15th. All these tools, not all these tools, but many of these AI editing tools will be coming, even if you use Google Photos on the iPhone, which I always find ironic. Like Google basically just puts a lot of its features on iPhone. Maybe this is why Google is not being sued by the DOJ because they share their features across platforms. But you'll be able to do things like the photo unblur, which, you know, if someone was a little blurry in a photo, it makes it clearer. The magic eraser, and you'll be able to do all this on your iPhone or older Google phones. And there's some specifications in this article about which phones will do it. Two features that will not be coming to iPhone and other phones that will still be exclusive to the Pixel 8 and Pixel 8 Pro is the best take feature, which was arguably one of the better features launched recently, where you take a bunch of photos of the same group of people and it will let you choose faces for each person. So everyone's looking at the camera and smiling. And the audio magic eraser, which is, it would basically clean up background noise or whatever if you were filming a video. So those remain exclusive to the newest Google Pixel phones, which, let's be honest, not many people probably have, but that's their, you know, they're keeping those too for themselves.
Yeah. And the only thing I want to say about this, just for our audience, because some people may be tuning out right now and be like, Google, Android, whatever. I just want to throw out Google Photos, by far the best way to back up your photos from your phone, to have a second backup. I have Google Photos on my on my phone, and I don't really ever use it for anything except for it just automatically sucks all of the photos that I take into Google Photos, so I now have them in two places. It's not like I plan on going anywhere, but it's so nice to know that, like, if you got locked out of your Apple ID because somebody stole your device and whatever happened, like, you have a second copy of them that's just in. Everybody has a Gmail account, right? Like, it's just attached to your Google account or whatever. So I thought I'd throw that out there for users, that if you are an iPhone user and you're not using Google Photos, like, just download the app and let it just do its thing in the background. It's fantastic.
I agree. I tried it with multiple apps years ago because Dropbox also has a functionality where if you have the Dropbox app on your iPhone, you can tell it to back up your photos. You know, give it full access to your library.
It really, really wants to back up all of your photos on every device you install Dropbox. Let's just be clear.
It really does. But I found Dropbox's implementation to not be as good as Google's. I do think Google Photos, if you want a backup of your photos, it's the way to do it. I did that as well for a long time. I stopped syncing it because every once in a while, Google Photos would like start backing up and my phone would get really hot. And I was like a little... You know,
because you're sometimes at the beach, apparently. You just keep you like to keep rubbing that into the rest of us.
No, I was burning my phone. My wife has it turned on, and I still have all my photos up probably to like 2018, 2019 are backed up in Google Photos. And then shared library is something that I use a lot. I don't know if you use shared library with your family, but shared library is a great feature on the iPhone where, you know, you could basically, when you're taking a picture, select this photo to go to the shared library, meaning you, your partner, or just trusted contacts, like you will all get these photos in your library once it syncs to iCloud, or you can select a bunch of photos and move it to the shared library after the fact. And so that's what I do. So if like we were at an event, it was like an end of school year celebration earlier this week, I took a bunch of photos and then that evening selected them all and moved it to the shared library. And so now they're on my wife's iPhone and iCloud account as well. And so that's kind of currently my quote unquote backup solution, but I'm probably going to turn Google Photos back on. That's probably a good idea.
It is. It's just a great way to have a second copy of all your photos. And it is actually a really easy way to share libraries with, like, if you just want to take a collection of photos and share them with someone, they don't necessarily have to. iCloud is fine because you can just download them now. It used to be kind of cumbersome, but it's great. So you don't have to worry about who you're sending them with. You can send them that link. They can open it and they can add them to their own library if they're using Google Photos. Compared to like the Dropbox thing where people are like, you gave me a Dropbox link. I don't know what this is. It's not a very good photo viewing experience. So I think it's great that these features are coming as well. I just think like there's probably a lot of our audience who are like, Google Photos, what? And I'm like, you should probably download it. It's worth it.
It is worth it. Listen, I mean, you know, I understand the consternation of using Google services, but Google Photos is great. Everybody still uses YouTube. You know, I see some people post on social media. They're like, I don't use any Google services except YouTube. It's like, well, okay. That's a pretty big one.
Right.
That's a pretty big one.
Yeah. So, did you see the Washington Post article? This was really about, they just published an article a couple days ago about how YouTube is the single most important app on the internet. And I think if you think about that, like, it is where people figure out how to change light bulbs in their car, right? Yes. It is where people figure out how to cook certain things. It is where you get entertained. It's where like you find out reviews of new devices you want. It's like, it's also by far the single most successful online economy, right?
Yes.
It does so much a better job than Facebook, than TikTok, than Instagram, than any of those things. The creator economy on I'm sending you this link, on YouTube is so much more. And so like the idea that people are like, you know, I don't use any Google services. Really? Come on. Like you don't ever watch a YouTube video. It is the second most popular search engine after Google search. And the number of videos that are just uploaded, like how is it possible that Google is able to run a service where people are just uploading an infinite amount of video content every single minute? It's just kind of mind blowing. So,
well, and I've seen other recent posts about if you're a creator making content, no other platform is going to surface a video you uploaded years ago to someone searching today. Like in Instagram, your real post video from 4 years ago, no one is ever going to see that again.
Right.
Like
you can't even find it again.
Can't even find it. Like it's never going to show it. And yet I'll go on YouTube and my two boys are doing more skateboarding now. And so they'll ask for like tutorials on how to do a skateboarding trick. And I will search for this trick and see the videos. And many of them that come up in the top are like 9 years old, 5 years old. and they have millions of views, and obviously still getting views because I'm about to watch it.
Yeah,
it's because it's a great resource, and that is something unique to YouTube, where it rewards quality content, which I think is a difference. I'm not saying there's not quality content on other platforms. TikTok, there's really incredible creators on there, very unique creative perspectives on there, but TikTok does not reward that kind of creativity like YouTube does. And so if you, you know, present a piece of information that's worthwhile, it's done with quality, you're providing value to the viewer, like you're saying, YouTube is the one platform that will reward that for literally years. Yep. And even I, like, the first video I ever published to my YouTube channel is about screen time settings on iPhone. I filmed it in the pandemic, like, with my iPhone. It was not great video quality, not great audio quality, but I'm still getting views on those videos today because I get comments. I'll see comments where people either ask or they'll say, thank you for this. And it's like, no other platform that's algorithmically driven is going to surface those kinds of old things. And I guess you could argue Google search can do that too. I mean, depending on what you search, although we talked about Google search last week and it's getting worse, and maybe that's not as true presently, you know, an article from several years ago would be something that, you know, if it's read by a lot of people and a lot of people found it valuable, it would be prioritized. So yeah, I agree.
Well, and the one difference between Google search and YouTube search is that the barrier to entry for YouTube is not high, but it is certainly higher than publishing text on the web. So there, so if what you really want is to figure out how do I change the headlight in my car, the answer you get from YouTube will probably get you the answer faster and be easier to understand than scrolling through 75 pages of like auto repair places or just people who are trying to sell you something else, right? Because the YouTube creator who put that up, if they're monetized, they just make money off of the ads that play, right? And there is, that doesn't mean YouTube is perfect. Like the reason every single video, even to replace a headlight on your car, is like what, 8 minutes long, is so that they can get a mid-roll ad or whatever. So it doesn't mean that it's not, I'm not saying it's perfect, but the barrier to entry is just high enough. There's just enough friction there that it is not complete garbage yet.
Right. No, and I'm hopeful about it. And speaking of money, let's just say you can watch Primary Technology on YouTube. And right now we crossed 600 subscribers.
All right.
So thank you for that, for all those who did that. But as Jason was saying, in order to monetize on YouTube, you do need 1,000 subscribers and 4,000 watch hours. The 4,000 watch hours on our channel, we're going to achieve that pretty quickly, but we need you. And so this is the ad spot for today's episode. And so our members don't get this because they've already supported the show, but you, viewer, you listener, if you're listening to this in your podcast player, go over to youtube.com. Search for Primary Technology, or just click the link down in the show notes and go subscribe to the YouTube channel over there. We want to try to get to 1,000 this year. I think we're going to do it pretty easily, but we could do it faster if you go there and follow and subscribe the channel there. And you can also support the show directly. We've had more and more people doing it every month, and we really appreciate the support. They're not hearing this because they're subscribers, so I cut this out. But so you know we're thanking them. And you, we're thanking you if you can go over and support the show either directly in Apple Podcasts. $5 a month, you get ad-free version, this portion cut out, but also bonus episodes every week. Today, we're going to talk about buying appliances, which is, Jason's about to go off on appliances, and I am too, because I had to get a repair part for my fridge, and that was a hassle. Anyway, so you get bonus episodes, and you get the entire back catalog of bonus episodes when you start supporting the show. Now, you can also do it at primarytech.fm, sign up through Memberful monthly or annually, and you get a feed with the bonus and ad-free episodes all at once. And so we thank you for those who do it. And if you can't do that, we understand. 5-star rating and review in Apple Podcasts is also very helpful. So thank you for supporting the show. And now back to Google Gemini and OpenAI getting in a little trouble for harvesting a bunch of data from what we were just talking about, YouTube.
Speaking of YouTube, yep.
Look at this. Look at this synergy. Basically, millions of hours were supposedly ingested by OpenAI to train ChatGPT. And Google Gemini, which I almost feel like maybe Google is okay-ish to like train its LLM model on its service. You know, it's Google. But anyway, they're getting in a little trouble because it's being discovered that they've been transcribing basically millions of hours of YouTube videos, training their LLM models. And I think this is going to be an increasing issue as we go forward with more AI models, where if you do a Google search and it surfaces some AI-generated article that was created because an LLM scraped a YouTube video, and now you've basically stolen a view from that creator and video because the search result is this AI-generated text based on it. I don't know. It's getting messy, and we don't really have tools or laws to help with this just yet. And I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you were trying to create a large language model that was capable of understanding humans and returning information in a format like natural language, YouTube seems like the obvious place to go, right? Because it is literally just billions of hours of humans, generally speaking, talking about things, right? So yes. Totally makes sense. I think the problem here is, you know, there was an interesting interview between Joanna Stern of the Wall Street Journal, and is it Mina Moradi, who was the chief technology officer, then for a very short time was the CEO when Sam Altman was kicked out, and now is back as, I think, the chief technology officer. And Joanna Stern just asked her, like, so what'd you train it on? And she's like, publicly available information. So she's like, so you mean like YouTube? And she's like, publicly available information. Like, I don't really know how that works. I'm like, you're the chief technology officer. You cannot say you do not know how this works. But like, literally Joanna Stern says, like, so videos on YouTube. And her answer is like, I'm not actually sure about that. But they definitely don't want to get sued. That's the reason that she's answering the question. She absolutely knows whether videos on YouTube were used. She just doesn't really want to say it on the record. And even for Google, I think the problem here is that when you upload a video to YouTube, you're not thinking that this will then be used to someday train a model that could replace what you're doing as a creator, right?
Yeah.
That's not the thing that you're like, sweet, upload. Let me push the upload button and now my career is over, right? That's not the way that this is supposed to work.
You know, I made a whole YouTube video yesterday and I didn't publish it because, I don't know, it didn't feel right. I'll put it in the show notes of this episode. So if the real ones want to go watch it. But I had some thought about, you know, the future of the creator economy with all this AI stuff. And we talked a little bit about, you know, last week and the week before, but I do think that I'm still semi-optimistic that with all the rise of AI generated content, that people will gravitate more towards a trusted voices mentality when it comes to a topic. And kind of like in the old days of the internet, where you would go to a website if you wanted to learn about a topic. You know, for me, in like the aughts, it was Engadget. I would go to Engadget every day because that's where I got my tech news. And I trusted the voices and the people that were there. At the time, it was actually Neil Patel and Joanna Stern and all of them at Engadget. And I think going forward, as it becomes harder and harder to identify what's AI content, what's real, I think people will be like, well, I'm not even going to try and figure that out. I'm just going to go to the people, the names that I trust to talk about a thing. And that's why if you're a creator today, if you're a writer like yourself, you make videos, you make podcasts, that really making sure that trustworthiness is almost one of the top priorities in everything you say and do. It's going to be more meaningful in the future because people are going to ask themselves, who can I trust about a topic? And if it's smart home or shortcuts, maybe they'll come to me. And there'll be multiple trusted voices. They can go to Shane Watley or Eric Wielander for smart home stuff because they're trusted voices. And I think that's going to be the goal in the near future, to become a trusted voice, almost like old school news anchors. And in my video, I talked about when I was growing up in New York, there was a name I still remember, Chuck Scarborough. He was like the NBC Channel 4 news anchor. And I saw him like every night on the 11 o'clock news. And he was a trusted voice. Why? I don't know, because I saw him every day. He reported on the news and it was just a name that I, you know, could identify. And if I say, oh, he's saying it, then I can believe it. And I think we're almost going to be moving back towards that trusted voice economy rather than like what's the top result in a Google search. And so I think that might be, I'm optimistic for creators for that economy. You just have to make sure you're trustworthy and you're doing good stuff. I don't know.
Yes, because I think the thing that the teens want the most are the old school news anchors.
Just listen, on YouTube. I know you're being facetious, but if you look at TikTok, you know, a clear example of maybe what a younger generation is looking for. What are they? You know, they go to that, and the algorithm feeds them videos it'll like. But they also identify with creators. Like Keith Lee is again a prime example of he became a trusted voice, where people are like, I'm going to watch every Keith Lee video. And like an old school news anchor, it became like, this is the person I want to see every night because I trust what he has to say, or he entertains me and I know it's him. And I like you just develop an affinity for him. And I think that's why the podcast medium is special still, especially audio podcasts, because when you listen to someone's voice for hours on end, for years on end, you just develop a connection. And it's like, this person has said things that I agree with or that I trust, and so I'm going to keep listening to them. So I think the young people do want news anchors. They're just not called news anchors.
They're just called creators. They're just called YouTubers.
They're YouTubers. And if TikTok still exists, who knows?
Well, and just to close the loop on all of this,
yes,
which is one of those phrases I hate, close the loop, but
open the kimono.
What a totally different connotation.
Yeah.
I don't even know what I was going to say. No, just linking it back, Washington Post article.
Yes.
Points out that among teenagers, YouTube is still more popular than TikTok.
There you go.
So, yeah.
That's it. That's it. All right. Well, let's, okay, I'm going to go back to Apple, and then we got some grab bag stuff. And I want to talk about our personal tech segment at the end, which is fast internet, because I'm obsessed with it. and there's way faster internet than we thought possible. But Apple is really pushing on Apple Vision Pro. I get PR emails a lot about Apple Vision Pro. And now the next push is into businesses, spatial computing, and businesses. And so this is a Newsroom article that came out just a couple days ago talking about all the business use cases. Some, I think, are unique. Some, it's like, okay, looking at analytics in augmented reality, okay, Microsoft 365 is still like pushed in these Newsroom articles. And it's like, listen, people know what Word and Excel are. I don't know if that's the selling point for Apple Vision Pro or WebEx and Zoom. But there was one use case I thought was interesting. They keep pushing Jigspace, Lowe's Style Studio. If you want to design a kitchen, you can do that in AR now. The one use case that I thought was interesting here was KLM, which is the airline. Instead of training on physical airplanes for maintenance, which I imagine they would still be part of the process, but they can train technicians using Apple Vision Pro and using that kind of augmented VR space to train on airplane maintenance, which that felt like that was kind of one of those use cases where I thought early on, like this would be really useful if you could like overlay instructions onto the thing you're looking at or be able to, you know, a car engine or an airplane, like this is saying, you know, be able to identify that. So really pushing hard on the business space. I don't know. My Vision Pro is still not even like here in the office. It's over in the other room. I haven't even updated it to the latest software. I was like, I don't know what to do with it, but I will be watching Dune 2 on it. I'll tell you that. I want to be doing that.
Well, and I actually think that this is an interesting sort of point for everyone. And that's that, you know, I published an article this morning, and my take on this is that Apple is actually starting to figure out what the killer app is for the Vision Pro and its business, which is weird because everyone who has been talking about it, at least in our circle, are not thinking about enterprise use cases for this. They're like, I want to watch Dune 2. I want to like watch the MLS highlights, which was a dud. You know, I want to like be courtsided at the NBA finals wearing my Vision Pro, like, and have my spatial persona buddy sitting next to me and we're watching again. Like, that's the future that people imagine. And I actually think probably we're going to get there. Okay. But I think the way that we get there is by building out sort of the platform, and the way that that's going to happen is with businesses. And I sort of, as I was thinking this through, kind of related it to think about laptops and smartphones, right? Laptops originally were designed for people who were road warriors, right? Like when you were a kid, did you have a laptop at your house? No, you had like a clunky PC sitting on the thing, and it had a console. Like there was a computer thing that you had to go to, and everybody shared the same one because they were expensive and they were big and they were just slow and whatever. Same thing's true with smartphones. Originally smartphones, I remember like one of my like first jobs after smartphones existed, I was working for FedEx, and the people who had the smartphones, like the Blackberries and the were the salespeople, the people who had to go out and have access to their messages and have those types of things. And it took time, but like they built out sort of that platform. And then eventually Apple came along and was like, we have a better idea. And it turns out that they were right. And they made that into a consumer device. And in fact, early iPhone days, you couldn't take your iPhone to work, right? You still had to use your BlackBerry because it had all of the corporate security stuff built into it and all that kind of stuff. And now you can have an iPhone that has both your business work iCloud and your personal next to each other because of the mobile device management and stuff. And so I actually think that Apple is hitting on something that's really important, because you can't figure out what to do with your thing that you spent $3,500 on, right? And nobody, everyone I know who has a Vision Pro is like, yeah, I use it maybe once a week, and
right.
or I use it because I need to write about it or do a video. And I'm like, that's not what the Vision Pro exists for, is just to make content. It exists for real world scenarios. And I think that, you know, the Porsche one was really interesting too. The example that they showed of like the race engineers can be monitoring with a 3D version of where the cars go, and like all these in camera dashes and dash cams and monitoring, you know, the speed and all that kind of stuff. Like, those are things you cannot do without spatial computing, right?
Right.
You can't do that on a computer screen. It's not the same. The KLM thing that you mentioned, that doesn't exist in the same way if you're just looking at a two-dimensional screen. And so I think, honestly, I think that this is the direction it's going to go for a while, and it's going to seem super boring to all of us. But do you know who is willing to spend $3,500 on a device that makes their people more effective, takes less time to train people? 100% companies, business, right? They will just throw money at something that makes their people more productive and saves them money somewhere else. And I think that as a result, that is what will build up the ecosystem of experiences and apps and that kind of thing. So it's boring, but I think it's what will get us there.
Well, and I'll say last week, after we recorded the show on Friday, I actually did the Spatial Personas with James Rath. He's a YouTube creator. He's also visually impaired. So he's going to be doing a whole video on kind of the accessibility from someone who's visually impaired perspective on Apple Vision Pro. But it was the first time I tried the Spatial Personas. I would have tried it with Jason, but he doesn't have one. But anyway, so I will say it was much cooler than just a regular FaceTime, because you had the disembodied head and hands being able to float around in the space is much more useful than like being relegated to the little box. And like, we opened up a freeform document and we were both able to collaborate on it. Like, we were sharing a whiteboard, and then we even played like a Battleship. There's a game app on the Apple Vision Pro where you could play like checkers, chess, Battleship, although they call it something else, probably because copyright. And like, if we were sitting across from each other at a table, I was at Mount Hood by the lake playing Battleship with James. And honestly, it was a really cool experience. It felt different and like good. Like, I would want to do that again. But the freeform whiteboarding thing, it wasn't perfect, and it's a little awkward like sharing it. But I could definitely see, you know, creative sessions that you might have had with a physical team in person. One day soon, like, you might just be able to do it from a completely remote team. And it did feel like I was with James, both of us like drawing on this whiteboard. Like, it felt much different than if you were to just share your screen, like using Zoom or whatever, and trying to whiteboard on your computer. Like, it did feel like we were both interacting with a shared space. And I think that's unique. And like you're saying, that's a business use case.
Yep.
And, you know, if maybe if it allows remote teams to collaborate more or better, then yeah, that might be the thing.
Yeah. And you know what costs more than $3,500 is flying people to meetings, right? And if you just sit there and look at a whiteboard, that doesn't seem like a very useful way to spend that kind of money. But if you had a remote team of people and they had that kind of technology that they could use for that sort of thing, I think, well, Ben Thompson from Stratechery talks about like just using the Oculus for the Horizon workrooms and having meetings that way, and how much better that is than Zoom. And I think that Cortex guys talk about that occasionally, where they will meet in that. And my, like, the perception there is that what Apple is doing is sort of a step in that direction, but even better, because Apple has all of the other things that you want to do, right? Your freeform board, your different types of the content that you actually need to work with. Your work is actually on your devices, as opposed to like with the Oculus, it's sort of a cumbersome way to get your device and your information in there. So I think that, again, what you just described, really cool as a consumer, right? I could see people doing that sort of thing. Like, hey, your kid goes off to college and you want to play chess with them and you have Vision Pros and you can sit down and do that kind of stuff. But really, that's primarily a business use case. And yet it will eventually make its way, I think, to consumers.
For sure. But what needs to happen before people can sit in there for hours is not get headaches or other things. And this was
You get headaches, or do you just not use it enough?
I mean, I've used it, like I watched Avatar Way of Water for 3.5 hours in it, and I did not get headaches. You do get eye fatigue, because your eyes are like, you know, the screen is just a couple inches from your eye, but your eye thinks it's focusing like a couple feet away. And so there is some fatigue there. And I find I have to purposefully blink more in Apple Vision Pro, because when you're, for some reason, like, I guess you just don't naturally blink as much. I don't know if it's because it's enclosed and maybe they don't, I'm not sure why, but I do notice I have to blink more. But anyways, this is an article from the New York Post saying that users are suffering from super dark black eyes after wearing the Apple Vision Pro for the first time. I'm not sure. It's the first I've ever heard of something like that. But obviously putting too much weight on the cheeks and some people getting headaches from just a couple hours in the Apple Vision Pro. And again, future models, Apple Vision Air or whatever, I think it's probably going to help some of these. The eye thing, though, I mean, the distance of your eye to those screens is not going to change. And I'm not sure, like, how Apple could address that. I'm also curious, percentage-wise, like, how many people are actually dealing with this. But
yeah, I think it's a very, that's the important part. A very small percentage of people are probably dealing with this. But if it's more than one, then it's now plural. Vision Pro users get a headache or whatever, right? You only need two to be able to say that. And it could be the person who wrote the article and someone else that they talked to. I'm not throwing shade at whoever wrote the article. I do think it's important because remember, we had the same story about the massive wave of returns that were happening, and it turned out it was like six YouTubers all returned theirs after they make their video, and then they made a video about returning it. Like, it is important to have context, but I do think it's an important point that if Apple wants people to wear these for a long period of time, then they need to take that feedback. I think that they probably will work on this sort of thing, because wasn't there a report recently that Apple was working on the ability to use this with different vision impairments without having to have the inserts, right? That they were going to try to come up with a way of dealing with that either in software or hardware without having to go through the process of ordering those Zeiss lenses, which would be great if you then wanted to share it with a spouse who had a very different prescription or something like that. So my guess is that they're absolutely thinking this through because they have invested a lot into this platform. Yes. I do not think that they want to see this go the way of the Newton, right? Where it's like, or even like the original HomePod, where like it came out and then like they couldn't sell out the stock. And so you could buy a new HomePod 6 years later and the manufacture date was like the day they launched or whatever. Yeah, so I think that they're probably working very hard on the kind of things that we're talking about.
There's also, this article is like wrote one Redditor.
Yeah.
And the Redditor also wrote, like, I don't know, sourcing like that. This is the New York Post. Like, this is... It's like legit. I don't know. That feels a little weird.
I mean, also, it is the New York Post.
Fair. I'm not going to include that one in the show notes. Anyway. All right, real quick. Mini lightning round. Last two things. Microsoft is confident that Windows on ARM, which I feel like I've been hearing about for 10 years, is finally going to beat Apple Silicon.
Both of them. It's going to meet the silicone cases and the silicone
made so many people mad. On the Apple Insider podcast, I said silicone one time when I meant silicon, and the wave of emails like, I can't believe it. They're very similar words, okay? These are not like very similar.
They're one letter different. So it's understandable.
Silicon. Anyway, they think that these new, it's the Snapdragon X Elite processors will finally be the performance Windows has been looking for to beat Apple Silicon. I'll believe it when I see it.
I think an important piece of this is, at least as far as I can understand, the article, the Tom Warren article. Tom Warren is one of the preeminent like Microsoft reporters out there. So like his sources are pretty good. But I think that what he's kept putting or reporting on here is internal beliefs. Like Apple or Microsoft is not running ads saying,
No.
We're going to beat the M3 Max or the M3 Ultra. Like,
right.
But... And to be fair, Microsoft has been, of all of the non-Apple hardware makers, creating really good hardware. Like the Surface laptops, the Surface Pro, like that stuff is good. If what you want is a Windows device, that stuff is very good. I think it will be very interesting to see what they actually come out with, because the important piece here is that Microsoft doesn't have 100% control over the Snapdragon X Elite, right? It is not a processor that is only tailored to exactly what Microsoft wants, where Apple Silicon, they can make all of the trade-offs and choices based on the end result and the performance that they want for their product. Right. And so I think that that's what the piece that is going to be really hard for them to overcome. Obviously, working very closely with Qualcomm on this, but I just think that it's a pretty big, they aren't making this claim publicly, so I feel like we can't drag them for it, but I think that they could be overly confident if what they think is that they're going to be able to be, even an M3 MacBook Air, like, honestly, I have one sitting right here. I could use this thing all day and never once wonder if there was a better computer out there.
Yeah. Well, and they're going to have an event next month, it looks like. It's going to be an event in Seattle, the AI PCs, and they're going to unveil, Microsoft's going to unveil what the future, its vision is for their computer. So we'll see,
Yep.
Competition is good. And also this from Engadget, ISPs, so internet service providers, are going to be required to roll out nutrition labels, much like the privacy nutrition labels that you see in like the App Store for privacy and security. But these nutrition labels are going to have to reveal all the hidden fees and other things that internet service providers don't put on their websites and on their pricing page. Also, like data caps and things like that. And so if there's a data usage policy and then throttled after it, they'll have to make these more visible, more known to users using these kind of nutrition label style things. I find it curious that I don't know how nutrition labels became the thing that we call all these things. I don't know if there's not a better word for it.
Well, it's just the metaphor that people understand that on a box of cereal, there's going to be this thing that it's standardized by the FDA so that you can quickly discern that. But I don't, do people pay attention to nutrition? I mean, I know some people do. Don't send me hate mail because it's really important to you. I personally have to look at them because I have a nut allergy. So like the way you find out if there's nuts in a thing is by looking at where the ingredients are and stuff. Yeah. I think it's kind of funny if they're actually going to make them look like this. And you know, also, where will you go to get this information? Because for example, on a box of cereal, it's on the box of cereal, or in the App Store, Apple has these privacy nutrition labels, but it's right there when you're downloading the app. So what it'll be weird to see how effective this is. But yes, I'm not usually a fan of regulation. This is like a no-brainer, please and thank you, because there is no worse corporate steward of our trust than Comcast and their competitors. Not just Comcast, their competitors. Yeah, because I remember during COVID, there was a period of time when I think Comcast waived this for some period of time. But it turns out that like your home internet probably has a data cap, which no one ever thinks about, right? I understand why on my mobile phone, maybe that's true. But on your home internet, and at a time when we had four kids on Zoom school, I was working remotely on Zoom all day, and the only other thing in the world we could do is watch movies because you couldn't go anywhere. Right. Every month we were exceeding that, and at one point Comcast wanted to charge you like $100 extra a month for it. They did waive it for part of the pandemic, but that's one of the primary reasons we switched, because Comcast around here, you can get 1 gig up or 1 gig down, I mean, and fast enough upload speeds. But we're switching to fiber because they don't care. They don't put a cap on anything. They don't nickel and dime you for, you know, whatever. And so I think this is good that sunshine is the best disinfectant. Making them reveal this information is going to put competitive pressure on why are you charging these fees? Why are you doing this? So
the one piece of information I wish would also be included in this, and from this article, it doesn't look like it will be a part of this initial rollout, is what they're doing with your data. Like, what data ISPs collect and who they sell that data to. Because, I mean, if you didn't know, they do that.
Yeah, we talked about this last week, didn't we? They know everything that you are doing on the internet. They know Steven and I are talking right now.
They do. They're listening in. Hello. Yeah. Hello, ISP.
Hey, Frontier. Comcast, what's up?
Yeah.
Actually, I don't have Comcast, so they can't hear this.
Oh, okay, anyway. They hear. But I think that would be eye-opening. And I imagine there's probably some lobbyists from the ISPs that would fight that. For reasons, but I think that would be really valuable and helpful to know as a consumer, to be like, who are they selling it to? How much of it are they selling? Should I look more into using a VPN on my home internet, which I do not. Like, I'm not like a whole home VPN thing, but I don't know. If I saw some kind of weird data about it, I might investigate.
But I mean, you can't use a whole home VPN because you are so obsessed with speed, and there's no VPN that's going to get you to that point. So
speaking of speed,
yeah,
for our personal tech segment,
I had to bring
up this article. Thank you. Apparently, Aston University researchers have developed a technology, a piece of hardware that can take the current fiber optic cables that run the internet around the world, which I think it was in a bonus episode a few weeks ago where we talked about the undersea internet cables that literally bring the internet across the oceans, which those are also fiber optic cables. Well, these researchers developed a piece of hardware that exponentially increase the speed capable using the same cables. So no new infrastructure required as far as fiber optic cables, but that it can send data at a speed that is 4.5 million times faster than the average home broadband. The academics transferred data at a rate of 301 terabits or 301 million megabytes per second using a single standard optical fiber cable. And I mean, I'll just be honest. I need to get Wi-Fi 58 now, or whatever it is, whatever that yep. will be. But I'm excited for this.
Yeah, and I think so. Like, this is good. I mean, this is an academic thing. I wanted to say about this is I think it's good for them to keep pushing the envelope on this sort of thing. At some point, and I don't think we're there yet, but the ISP or the connection point, the pipes, is actually not the limiting factor anymore, right? Because all of your data is served off of a CDN somewhere. So it's servers. Like, there will come a point in time where we have exceeded that, but we are so far away from that at this point. Like, this article says that the average broadband speed is 69 megabits per second. So that means that there are people who are paying for internet whose maximum speed that they're capping out at is less than 100 megabits per second, right? Yeah. And there's a whole lot of people who are below that, right? Because Steven's got like 26 gigs a second or something like that, which means he's way offsetting this average for a lot of people. So there's a whole bunch of people with like five up and down. Like,
I know. And listen, I'm sorry. We want you to have better internet, and then hopefully,
absolutely,
hopefully this will bring it to pass. But
I think didn't the FCC just recently? I'm partially making this up because I don't remember all the details, but I believe that it's true.
Trustworthiness.
That the FCC recently changed the minimum required speed to call it broadband. I don't know if it's like 25 megabits up and down or something like that. I know Steven's going to look it up for me while I keep rambling for a second, but I'm pretty sure they did.
You're right. You know, you're right. You're right. So this is, let me share this article. You called it. This was still trustworthy. This was accurate. The FCC just quadrupled minimum broadband internet speeds. The new definition of broadband raises the standard to 100 megabits down and 20 megabits up. This was from March 15th.
So that means it used to be that they could call it broadband if it was 25. Think about that. They could call it broadband internet if all they were giving you is 25 megabits per second.
And so, 3 up.
Yeah.
3 megabits up was considered broadband. So, yes.
I can run faster than that, Steven. And I have not run in 20 years, but I can run faster than 3 megabits a second.
I would like, you know, I like that the visual of how fast would 3 megabits up be if it was someone running down the street.
Absolutely.
But I'm excited. So, personal tech in the near future, we're less than 2 months away from WWDC 2024. We're going to see iOS 18, VisionOS 2.0. And so Jason and I are going to reveal our lists for what we are hoping to see, maybe what we think we'll see. So we want to hear from you guys. You can email us, podcast@primarytech.fm. You can send us replies on Threads or X. All of our social handles are in the show notes. But we want to hear, what are you looking for in iOS 18? And maybe bugs that you hope are fixed. Screen time. Still hoping for screen time to be fixed.
Amen.
I just want to approve screen time requests from my Apple Watch. It used to work.
Yeah.
It used to work.
Mine still works. My problem is that all of a sudden screen time will just like turn off on some of our kids' devices. And then I will look at what they've been doing. And it's like, you have 17 hours of YouTube from yesterday. I don't remember approving a request.
You weren't even awake that long.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. Did you just have them on your phone looping YouTube videos? Were you just really trying to help Steven's viewer count?
That's right.
Is that what you were doing?
That's where it's coming from.
Okay. Steven's approving my kids' screen time requests.
I'm getting the requests.
This cable that I ran from my house to Steven's house is just approving screen time requests constantly.
That's right. So yeah, that would be great to be fixed. But anyway, let us know what you are wanting from iOS 18, iPadOS 18. We'd love to see some upgrades to iPad as well. But we're going to do that in an episode soon, probably May, as we approach WWDC, because there'll probably be rumors about what's going to be coming.
Yeah.
You know, Mark Erman, he'll probably tell you. But we're going to go and record a bonus episode about appliances, which have you listened to John Siracusa about his many escapades?
Well, they're one of the most classic...
The fridge.
Famous, yeah, episodes of ATP of all time. It was ATP, right? I think it was ATP,
Reconcilable Differences.
I can't remember which of the two shows it was, but it was called,
about it, on
it was Preparing the Way for the Fridge,
preparing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that might have been a Rectives episode where he was talking about his new fridge. But anyway, we're going to talk about appliances, which is definitely technology tangentially related. But if you want to listen to that, again, support the show on Apple Podcast. You can go to primarytech.fm, support us on Memberful, or give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcast. We appreciate that as well. Thanks for tuning in and listening. We'll catch you next week.